Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. No doubt you've heard of the headhunters of the Amazon. Perhaps you've even seen some of those little shrunken heads as if they're enemies that they process, shrinking them down. Well, our guest, John Perkins, has lived among them. As early as 1968, when he was a Peace Corps volunteer, he met the Shuar and has since grown to love and appreciate their culture and has written a book called The Spirit of the Shuar, Wisdom from the Last Unconquered People of the Amazon. John joins us from New Hampshire. Hi, John. Welcome back.
Thank you, Loralee. It's great to be here.
Well, I mentioned that you're with the Dream Change Network and you do some wonderful work helping to introduce the ways and information about shamanism throughout the world. There's so much we can learn from those ancient cultures and apply to our own. Headhunting may not be one of them, but they do much more than just headhunting. Tell me a little bit about the Shuar and how you first came to visit them.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in 1968. I just graduated from business school and joined the Peace Corps, and I actually requested the Amazon. It had been a place that had fascinated my imagination since I was a child. And the Peace Corps sent me deep, deep into the Amazon to live and work with the Shuar, who, as you mentioned, are headhunters. If you've ever seen a picture of a shrunken head or seen a real shrunken head, they did it because they're the only people in the world today that do that.
Now, I've always wondered, do they take the bones out? I mean, what kind of herbs, you know, what are they doing to get it to shrink down?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's really pretty simple.
I just have to get that one out of the way first.
Well, they after they kill their enemy, they believe that everybody has three spirits, and one of those spirits is a vengeful spirit that will come back and haunt you after you've killed an enemy.
So they're the ones that also tie the lips shut.
Yeah, so they after they kill the enemy, they cut off the head, and they make a slit up the back of the head. They remove the skull and everything else that's inside the head, so everything's taken out. And then they sew everything up, the eyes, the lips, the nose, the ears. That's to keep the vengeful spirit in there. And then they shrink it basically through hot water, and later when it gets smaller by putting in hot stones and hot sand when it gets really small. And they are actually shrinking this soul, this vengeful spirit, inside the head. And then they introduce it to their own community. They bring it home. They do a lot of ceremonies around it. And introduce it to their own community and sort of put it at peace.
This is on beyond the scalp, which I understand was not really a Native American custom, but a French custom.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's quite different from that. I think scalping was started originally as sort of a bounty so that the Indians could prove to their allies, the French and later the British allies, that they'd actually killed enemies and they get paid for that. I think that's where I read that that's where that started. This is very different. It's actually very, very much of a religious sort of thing. And it might interest you to know that in Northern California, there's a woman, a psychotherapist named Mary Tendall, who is one of our trip leaders for Dream Change Coalition, works for the same group as me, has been working with the Shuar since 1990, more or less, taking groups in also. And she's a psychotherapist who specializes in Vietnam veterans.
Huh.
And it's been very fascinating that many of those veterans also are overwhelmed with a sense of guilt, a sense of haunting of the men that they killed and the things that they did during the war. And she has introduced a process that's kind of like the equivalent of head shrinking, whereby they visualize or use sometimes clay and other materials to kind of shrink that vengeful soul that's haunting them into something else and put it to rest. Not quite the same thing. There are not. If you go into Nevada City, California, you won't find a whole lot of shrunken heads on posts. But there is a psychotherapist named Mary Tyndall there who does something that she bases upon what she's learned from the schwa, which is very interesting.
You know, I think that's one of the gifts of ceremony and ritual is the process that it puts you through for the performing of it. It's not that you end up with some magic at the end necessarily. It's the process psychologically that the transformational for yourself, I think, is one of the gifts, isn't it?
Absolutely. We do a lot of workshops here in the States on shape-shifting and on something the schwa refer to as a rootum, which is the life's force. It is something that we can bring into ourselves to give ourselves more courage, more faith in ourselves, and an ability to move forward and do the things in life that we really want to do. And in doing the workshops here in the United States, we find that using many of these indigenous techniques, not just from the schwa, but from people all over the world, and using the rituals associated with these, we're really able to help people transform their lives and become happier and more fulfilled people.
And Rutam, you spell A-R-U-T-A-M. You worked with one member of the schwa tribe, Shakayi Mariano Chumpi, there. And what you're telling is his story in your book, Spirit of the Schwa. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, we'll call him by his Spanish name, Mariano, although his schwa name is Shakayim, which means spirit of the forest. Beautiful name. He's a young man in his late 20s who is also my blood brother, called an Amikri, and his children are like my children. It's a very close relationship, which is interesting because I'm in my late 50s. He's in his late 20s. And really, this book, Spirit of the Schwa, we wrote together. It was the idea of my publisher, Ehud Sperling, who spent time there and said, why don't you give tape recorders to some of the young schwa, like Shakayim Mariano, and ask them to go out and interview the very, very old people, the elders, and ask them about their sex lives, which are very, very interesting, their initiation ceremonies, their use of psychotropic plants, their vision quests, the wars that they used to conduct, and Aruta, this power. And also interview some of the younger people and see how things have changed over time and what the older people have to say about some of these situations. So Mariano spent a couple of years traveling all over the rainforest with small tape recorders and talking to the elders, and then brought the tapes back and we translated them here. And that's a large part of this book, Spirit of the Schwa. So I really don't take a lot of credit for the book as an author. I told my story a little bit in it too, but my story has been told in other books. And so this is really their story. This is truly the story of the schwa, and it's told by the older people speaking to this young man who himself is a great warrior.
Tell us about some of those intriguing practices. We'll get to the sex later. But the shape-shifting, what do they mean by that? Is that a state of consciousness? Tell us about that.
For the schwa, first of all, don't believe in death. They believe in what we would call reincarnation. And they believe there's great power in that, and the ancestors can teach us all and give us all a lot of advice as well as a lot of arutam power if we journey to them. And when a person dies, his spirit or her spirit shapeshifts into an anaconda or a jaguar or a powerful plant like the ayahuasca plant, which is what we call a psychotropic. And in that form, it can be very helpful to people in this life or to other animals or other trees. But in fact, you don't have to wait till death. You can create these shapeshifts even while you're alive if you have lots of aruta. And so there are instances of people today shapeshifting into a jaguar or an anaconda for a couple of hours in order to accomplish some task.
And that's a visionary journey?
Pardon me?
As a visionary journey?
Yes, it's done in a visionary journey. And it can happen physically, too. There are a lot of stories also amongst North American indigenous people of them doing these sorts of things, shape-shifting into the buffalo in order to be better hunters of the buffalo, shape-shifting into trees in order to hide from enemies. So this process of shape-shifting is a very, very powerful one. And, we can call it by many, many different names. But in our own culture, we have a lot of physical shape shifts that, for example, people sometimes will develop a cancer very suddenly and maybe get rid of it very suddenly, too. That's a real physical shapeshift. There's something happening to us.
So the body is pretty malleable under certain circumstances, you're saying?
Yeah, and it's, you know, we have a lot of scientists that go on these trips to the Amazon with us, and incidentally, we have trips frequently that are described on our website, dreamchange.org, and anybody can go. This isn't restricted to medical doctors or physicists or anybody else. We have people from all walks of life going, including a lot of scientists and a lot of medical doctors who become very interested in the healing techniques, and, you know, they're applying modern scientific theories to how this shape-shifting happens, and what really is going on here. And it's interesting to me that modern science tell us that, well, you know, Einstein said matter and energy never disappear. They just shape-shift, just change forms. And we know that we're 99.999% air, and the other 0.0001% we used to call subatomic particles, and now the physicists tell us they're not even particles. They're probabilities of energy, the string theory. So what are we really?
Have you had scientists and doctors witness somebody shifting, not just a visionary journey, but someone shifting into a whole different shape?
Oh, yes, absolutely. On some of the trips, some of the shamans have shape-shifted in front of people. One shape-shifted into a bat. One shape-shifted into a jaguar. We've had people watch this. Eve Bruce is another one of our trip leaders and a medical doctor, has a book coming out in January called Shaman MD. Talks in her book about how amazed she was on one of her first trips to Ecuador, coming from a very scientific background, not really going in with any belief in any of these things, seeing one of these shape-shifts occur. We had a number of our people heal through shape-shifting, and one very good example was a deaf woman, been deaf since she was 10. She was now in her mid-30s. She got something called Cogan's disease, which is very rare in the United States, but it's almost always permanent. It results in permanent deafness. And in one night with one of these shamans, he did a shape-shifting ceremony on her, and she regained her hearing. It's been very well documented and written up in several magazines, like Health Magazine. It's described in detail in the book Spirit of the Schwa, along with a number of references to some of the scientific journals that have studied it. It happened. Her ear, you know, the problem inside of her ear disappeared in one night.
How do they practice medicine, the Shuar?
They practice a couple of different types of medicine. And I say a couple, and yet within those couple, there's a lot of variations also. But there's the plant medicine, and that's practiced primarily by women shamans who do a lot of work with the plants. Now, they see the plants as it's about plant spirits, not about the chemical composition of the plant. So a lot of different plants sometimes can be used to do the same thing. Because in parts of the jungle, you'll find one kind of plant, another part of the jungle, you won't find it, but you'll find something else. And from a scientific standpoint, we don't necessarily classify these plants the same. But for the schwa, the spirit of the plant can work the same. And they make them into poultices, or they make them into teas for people to drink, depending on what's wrong with you. We had a woman on one trip recently who sprained her ankle in the Andes before going down into the Amazon. Couldn't walk, was in great pain. Her foot had swollen up to something the size of, you know, like a coconut. I mean, it was huge. And this schwa woman used a local plant. And made a poultice and put it around her foot and said, well, you'll be better within 24 hours.
And she was?
And she was. So that's one form. A second form is what the Shuar call the teacher plants, which are Datura, ayahuasca, and a local tobacco, which is very, very powerful. These are journeying plants. We call them psychotropics or hallucinogenics. To them, there's nothing hallucinogenic about it if you define hallucinogen is taking you away from reality.
Oh, it's bringing you closer.
Yeah.
The way that they use it.
Bringing you deeper into reality. And there are these very powerful visionary journeying experiences that people have. And so those are basically the two types of healing work that they do.
As anyone explain to some of the elders the way that most Western people take drugs or mind-altering drugs, and what do they think of that? It's such a different intent.
We've talked about that, and some of these shamans have been here to the United States. Every year we do a gathering of shamans at the MA Institute in upstate New York. We've got one coming up this year in October, which is for 8 days. And we'll have a Shwa shaman there. They come here, they've seen these things. We've talked to them a lot about it. And their take on that is basically around intent. And that when people take substances, and I'm talking here about, let's call them organic or plant substances. They really don't comment much on the purely chemical substances like LSD. That's a little out of their realm. But in talking about something like the plant substances, whether it's marijuana or Datura or ayahuasca or whatever, they feel very strongly that if you take it with the intent of learning, of going deeper into yourself and to the situation that maybe a community faces, such as around the environment, then there's no danger. There's no fear of addiction. There's no danger. There's only learning. And it may sometimes be painful because you may have to confront things that you've been trying to avoid. So there can be some pain, but it's a good pain that you can put behind you. If, on the other hand, your intent is to escape from reality, then that can lead to serious problems. And they see in our culture people taking substances, whether it's alcohol or tobacco or drugs.
Sugar,
as a way of escaping, disassociating from reality. And for them, that's totally absurd, because if you live in the jungle, you can't disassociate from reality and survive. So you kind of combine the two. There's no separation between, you know, being in the reality and also being on the journey into a deeper reality that's an inner reality.
So their world is just a little wider than ours, for the most part, in terms of sense of reality and arena. So they're saying the plant spirit of the plant knows your intent, understands that. What do they think of Western doctors and Western medicine that just takes a plant and isolates one part of it and tries to use that as medicine, as opposed to the way that they use medicinal plants?
Well, they feel that we're missing out on an awful lot by doing that. They also can see that for certain things, this works very, very well. You know, we spent some time with some of these shamans. 3 years ago, we invited a group of them up to Ann Arbor, Michigan, to the University of Michigan Medical School, where we had about 200 people from the medical school working with the shamans doing some teaching, and an exchange of teachings. It was very fascinating. And the shamans have seen that some antibiotics, for example, can be extremely helpful in healing, you know, severe infections. And they're also very impressed with what we can do through surgery. This woman I mentioned earlier, Eve Bruce, is a surgeon. And through bone setting, those types of things, it's been very helpful for them to learn some of that.
We do excel at certain aspects, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the key here is that, you know, that they're very, very open to looking at the way we do this and to trying to learn from it. And increasingly, many people in our medical community are becoming open to their ways, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really good, because both ways have something very, very important to offer.
I agree.
And they're not mutually exclusive.
I agree with that, too. Some of their ways are a bit more foreign to our Puritan ethics. Tell us about the ecstatic sex and how older women might initiate younger men into how to pleasure women and all of that.
Yes. This is a conversation that it can be a little bit delicate for some people, but for the Schwa,
well, it's good to understand that just the way that our customs aren't the only way that humans can arrange their customs. So we
right.
need to be a little more open-minded, I think, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, for the Schwa, the most important thing in life, and this is also true for many other indigenous people, I've worked with people in Iran and Indonesia and all over the world, and there's a lot of similarities. It's very, very important connection with nature, with the plants and the animals, and what I think you could describe as the ecstatic experience of oneness. And there's many different ways to do that, but one of them is orgasm. And they feel that when you're going through that state, that orgasmic state, that's not about the other person particularly, or it's not about yourself. It is about both of those things, but it's also about feeling deep within inside yourself your oneness with everything. That it's a deep connection. And for the schwa, this is something that they like to practice a great deal of. They like very prolonged orgasmic experiences. And it has nothing to do with loyalty. So for the schwa are very loyal to their families, extremely loyal and protective of their families. But sharing orgasm with someone else doesn't, if you do it with someone who's not your immediate spouse, that's not a threat to your spouse. That actually is something that benefits bonding for the whole community. And, you know, it's interesting, as I look at other cultures, as I research this, and we look at things like May Day, which was the Beltane fires for the Celtic people, something very similar was going on there. We look at, in North America, I come from New Hampshire, where the Abnakis were, and if you read histories, you see that whenever a stranger went into an Abnaki community or an Iroquois community, if it was a man, several women would come in and spend time with that person, and they would share this ecstatic experience. And anthropologists tell us it was also a way of expanding the gene pool. It was, you know, a biological thing too. I don't know whether they thought about that, but I do know that they felt, or at least I know that the schwa feel, that this is an important part of sharing with another person our oneness with everything around us.
Do they have homosexuality there? I mean, do they have, and how would they deal with that?
Well, for the schwa, the relationship between men and women is an extremely important one. The two genders are considered absolutely equal, but very different, and each one has different roles. For example, only the men hunt and kill animals, which are very necessary for protein. Only the women make chicha, which is a mild type of beer that's very important in the schwa life. So men and women are always together. You never find a man living alone or just with other men, and you never find women living alone or just with other women. If men are going out of their own hunting territory, just a group of men by themselves, they're considered extremely dangerous. They're warriors. Why would you go without women unless you're on the war path?
Or hunting?
Well, with hunting, you're in your own territory.
Oh, I see. You said outside your territory.
Yeah,
got it.
So you know what your territory is, and you don't hunt in another man's territory. You get into trouble.
Uh-huh. It can start a war.
Yeah, it can start a war. So if you're outside of your territory and you're with several other men and no women are there, you're considered very dangerous.
Now, did the schwa
if there are women traveling with you, then you're probably going on a social visit.
Oh, I see. So it's okay to be outside your territory as long as your women folk are there, because that means you're going for a visit.
Right.
Now, do the schwa all share one territory, or are there various tribes among the schwa that divide their territory? And how many members are left these days?
Well, there's a lot. The schwa are one of the Amazonian cultures whose population has expanded in the last 30 years. When I was there in 1968, I lived with them for about 3 years, they were approximately 7,000. And anthropologists tell us that the number probably, to be successful hunters and gatherers, was always under 10,000. Then the wars were made illegal, the big headhunting wars. They still do some headhunting, but not the big wars. And medical missionaries came in and gave vaccinations and so forth. Today, the schwa number about 70,000.
Wow.
So in a little over 30 years, they've increased.
Tenfold increase.
Tenfold. And that's not a particularly good thing for many of them, because they've overpopulated to the point where they can't live off hunting and gathering anymore in many parts of schwa territory. It's a vast territory, but many parts of it now, they've become quite dependent on the outside world, working for construction companies or whatever.
So even though they call themselves an unconquered people, somehow Western civilization is making its impact.
Yes. In the traditional area where I was a Peace Corps volunteer, which is an area between two mountain ranges, the Andes and the Kutuku, which is a traditional territory, now roads have gone in there. And civilization, as we know it, has gone in. And many of the Shawan have stayed there and become part of that. But there's another group of Shwa who've moved further into the jungle beyond the Kutuku. And that's where we take our groups. You have to fly in single-engine airplanes and go down the river and dugout canoes and then hike a little bit. You're very, very deep in the jungle. These Shwa have gone into that area specifically and consciously to keep their traditional ways.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones that really consider themselves totally unconquered. No Shwa has signed a peace treaty, but many have sort of been, you know, co-opted or incorporated into our system. These particular ones, the ones who we visit, had intentionally stayed apart because they really respect their old ways.
So they don't have a problem with the young people wanting to follow the old traditional ways?
Well, some of the young people don't
have
want
a choice
to follow the old traditional ways.
Mm-hmm.
And they're free to move into the other part where the Shwa are mixing. They're free to move back across the Kutuku into this area or anywhere they want. There's Shwa who've been to college, the Shwa who've come here to the United States to been to college. Many of them go back, ultimately, to this the remote area, which they call Trans-Kutuku, beyond the Kutuku. But they feel that it's really important for them, each person, to make his own choice.
And that's, for me, one of the hallmarks of freedom, too. You have a choice to exercise where you want to be within a wide culture. John, we need to take a break, and we want to mention John's book, a fascinating read, Spirit of the Shuar, Wisdom from the Last Unconquered People of the Amazon. We'll be back for more stories from the Amazon among the Shuar. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is John Perkins, founder of the Dream Change Coalition and author of Spirit of the Shuar, Wisdom from the Last Unconquered People of the Amazon. John, is the warfare, the ritualized warfare, one of the ways in which this hunter-gatherer society, the Shuar, for many millennia has practiced population control among their, you know, the neighboring hunter-gatherer society? And you mentioned that they believe war is a path to peace and balance. How do they understand that?
Yes, Laura, that's a fascinating question. And, you know, I do workshops around the country, and it's always, you know, interesting to see people's responses, because I think one of the most fascinating things, I just deviate a little bit here from your question, but about the Shwa is how many buttons they push on people when you talk about psychotropic plants or their sex lives or their warfare or head shrinking. It really pushes buttons. But the Shwa have these a whole series of mythologies and stories, which some of the older ones tell beautifully in the book Spirit of the Shwa. And a lot of them are around population control, because the Shwa have recognized for thousands of years, I suppose, nobody knows how long ago it started, that they live in a very, very fragile environment, and they have no natural enemies except other human beings. And a number of their mythologies talk about this. The stories they tell in the book tell about how, you know, the gods have come down and told them that they have to control their population and that they need to look out for future generations, but not just future generations of other people, of Shwa, but also the future generations of all the animals and all the trees. That they have this incredible responsibility because they're the only ones in the forest with no natural enemies. And so they have been admonished throughout time by their gods and goddesses and their mythologies and legends to take control of their populations. And they've made certain deals at times, which are part of these stories, in order to fight off these mythological enemies called the Evias, which are great white cannibals. Interesting, great white cannibals. They look a little bit like us because we're a lot taller than the Shwa. They made these deals with their gods that if their population gets out of control, they will weed themselves, just as they have to weed the yucca plants, the manioc, which is a very important plant to them. You don't just have to weed other plants, weeds, out of a garden. You also have to weed the manioc itself. In order for a few to grow, you have to take out some of the ones. They made these deals whereby if they don't control population through other means, then as a last resort, They'll do it through warfare because they recognize this as being part of their responsibility. They take great pride in being responsible for taking care of their environment, not just human beings, but future generations of all the plants and animals and the rivers.
Now, do they also practice a form of birth control via some of the herbs? Because I understand many ancient societies use certain plants as natural birth control means.
They do. And also, this goes along with the conversation we had earlier about orgasm. The Shwa do not make a connection between orgasm and intercourse. And so intercourse is about creating babies. And the woman is in charge of that. And if she wants to have another child, then she'll practice that. But so much of Shwa sexual activity is around non-intercourse orgasm. And that, of course, in itself is a way not only of controlling populations, but also of controlling diseases. Mm-hmm. So they practice that. And in addition, the women have a tremendous knowledge of herbs that they can use to prevent pregnancy or to cause children to abort at a very early stage.
Back to the warfare aspect, how do they set this up? You know, do you go to the next tribe and go, gee, we have a few too many members, let's go to war? I mean, what starts a war, and what are some of the rules of warfare?
It's much more subtle than
I would think so.
Many of the wars have gone on for centuries. It's a little bit, you know, like Romeo and Juliet, the Capulets and the Montagues. Uh-huh. Things go back a long, long time, and nobody knows where they started. But they don't usually get active unless population starts to get out of control. Uh-huh. So then they remember some of the old rivalries, and they go to war again. Some of these wars started out of love triangles. Some of them started out of black magic. Nobody really knows where a lot of them started from. But they do seem to get more active as population.
Is it formalized so that the other side knows that you're coming, or do they have sneak raids and attacks?
It's usually the other side knows or should know.
Or their shamans are doing their job, they would know, right?
Well, yes, and they almost always know when something like this is going to happen. Although on the exact morning, it usually happens at pre-dawn, when the raid takes place, they very well may not know and may not be prepared. So there are many sneak attacks, but the people who are being attacked know that there's a likelihood, and if they're not prepared, that's their problem.
What do they fight with? Spears, arrows, poison arrows?
Traditionally, spears, which they don't throw. They're thrusting spears. It's all hand-to-hand combat.
Makes it more honorable that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. And today they also have some single-shot, muzzle-loaded guns, kind of like flintlock Davy Crockett guns that are made in Ecuador today. You can buy one for $70. Hmm. And that's a lot of money for the Shwa. So if somebody has one of those, that's pretty special. But they do. Some of them have those, and by our standards, they're still very, very primitive. But to them, that's pretty advanced. So they have a number of different things. And today they also have machetes, which they didn't have in the old days. But today they use machetes also, like big swords, you know, cutlasses. And incidentally, Laura Lee, speaking about this population thing, I'm also fascinated by the fact that I think in North America, we had something very similar going on. If you read the histories, and we know so little about the histories because it's also biased. It comes to us, you know,
indeed,
from so many different sources. Whereas with the Shwa, it's still going on. It's not just history; it's happening today. But if you look at the history of indigenous peoples in this country, it looks as though they used to battle each other and count coups often without killing each other. You just rode into an enemy's territory, or you rushed in and you tapped the enemy. And you thought that was a great macho thing to do, you know, the son of a great warrior. But at other times, they went into the enemy's territory and killed.
Uh-huh.
And I have a strong belief, which I can't prove, but that it was very similar to the Shwa, that there was a consciousness of population. And it was a consciousness of when game began to get scarce, when the environment became unbalanced because of too many people, and that indigenous people around the world have always sought to restore the balance.
We'll be talking with an anthropologist soon who has been studying hunter-gatherers throughout history, and he believes that the mammoth and other big mammals here went extinct because of human hunting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And he says that, like Easter Island, will always overtake it, the environment, and always do damage unless you employ some sort of restraints consciously.
Yes.
What about women? Are there then more women in that population than men because the men are out killing themselves and the women stay home?
That's correct. Now, things are changing these days, but traditionally there have always been more women than men. And the culture is matriarchal in that when a couple gets married, they go and live with the wife's family for a while, and bloodlines and lineages are passed on through the women. But it's also the case that traditionally they're polygamous. So there's a lot more women than men. And as I mentioned earlier, men and women never live alone. So there would often be two to four women living with a man as his wives. But interestingly, these women had a tremendous amount of freedom within that, within the limitations that were obviously imposed by that. One was that a woman can, and this is still true, can always leave a man whenever she wants. She just has to walk out of the house, and she can either take her children with her or leave them with the man, and he must take care of them. And she goes and lives with her old family, her parents, for a period of time, around 6 months, and then she's free to do what she wants. So she can leave at any time. The man can't do that. He's obliged to take care of the women as long as they're there.
Do the women need a man in their life in order to bring home food, or do they all share it? Because what would happen to a family if when the man dies in a war or is captured?
The woman immediately go to somebody else, and it's usually a brother. So if I have a brother who's killed in war, I must open my doors to his wives, and they'll come and live with me for whatever amount of time they want to. And then it's up to them to decide whether they want to stay with me, whether they want to move on to be with someone else. But, yeah, they will not live by themselves or with just a community of women. There will always be men because men are the hunters and the warriors, and women take care of the dogs and the children and the gardens and introduce teacher. All of these are very essential tasks that don't cross those lines.
But the women feel very free. How do they deal with jealousies and, you know, all those little... If they're living so close, you know, we like to sleep in our own bedrooms alone. We like to have time alone. We're very solitary people, aren't we? We like to go off and meditate. It's hard in a village when the dogs are barking, the children are running around, and you can never be alone. But then there's the jungle across the way, I guess. So,
The Shwa don't, you know, they don't look for this alone time. The men get it practically every day when they go out hunting early in the morning.
And then, I guess, and those visionary journeys with the plants.
Right,
I guess that's
right.
Your time to, just
right.
Between you and God.
Right. But they don't have the same feeling of a need for a private space in the house. Although, if there's a couple of wives in the house, they will each have their own part of the house where they keep their stuff. They don't have a lot of stuff. The Shwa are very unmaterialistic. But they'll each have their own part of the house. And yet, people are not looking for alone time. They get the alone time, as you said, in the journeying space, and also the women working in the gardens, the men hunting. But another interesting aspect of this, you know, polygamy thing is that if a man has, let's say, two wives, when he goes hunting or goes off to war or goes off for the day, these women are free to invite young men who are uninitiated in the ways of sex into their house, or actually they always make love in the jungle near the house, not in the house. They go out into the jungle to be one with the jungle. And they'll bring these young men in to train them in ways to please a woman sexually. Even though, you know,
now, this is why it works for women this way, I'm
right,
sure. If
right.
That wasn't there, then the women might be getting the raw end of the deal. But
yes, but they have plenty of opportunities to train these young men and how to please them. And later on, these younger men, as they get a little older, they will train younger women as the women reach puberty. And so there's this constant flow of older people training younger members of the opposite sex in the art of lovemaking. And, you know, it's funny because when we take groups begin to live with a schwan for a short period of time, we'll sit around and talk about these things very openly with them. They love to talk with our groups. And many times the schwan will ask, well, how do you people do it in your country? And when you sort of say, well, you take two teenagers and you send them off, or they sneak off someplace and they don't know anything about anything, and they sort of struggle through it to learn about it, the schwan will look at us with horror. It's kind of like, man, are you barbaric? Are you uncivilized?
The blind leading the blind.
Right. Right. How can you leave such an important thing to chance, perspective, and perception?
Well, there's many ways to construct a society. I'm sure that down through the ages, various human groups have tried them all. Your own experiences, now I'm going to ask you about your sexual experiences, your own experiences with the various plants. We have talked to people who've tried the ayahuasca. I've never talked to anyone who's tried datura or tobacco as a mind-altering drug, or mind-altering plant spirit friend. Let me put it that way.
Well,
would you like to share any experiences?
Pardon me?
Would you like to share any experiences?
Sure.
With this
child? tobacco, and they constantly refer to it as spirit of the schwa. It is the main plant because they grow it and they take it a lot. And it's a very powerful tobacco. There are anthropologists who theorize that it's what the Native North Americans also used in their peace pipes and never passed on to the whites. It basically went extinct in this country.
You mean the very species of tobacco that was used?
Yes.
Oh,
this is
man.
A theory, and I don't know whether it's valid or not. Hmm. But the schwa, and throughout the Amazon, is this very powerful species of wild tobacco. We call it wild, although they cultivate it down themselves. And they dry it, and then they make it into a liquid, and they sniff it up their noses. They force it in their hands and sniff it through their noses, and it gives you quite a jolt when you do that. And it's quite mild, but very beautiful. And the more you experience it, the more you work with the spirit of this tobacco plant, the more powerful it becomes. And, it doesn't become any more powerful, chemically speaking. It's just this relationship that's developed. And I personally love it. The schwa always send me, off with a bunch of it and say, before you do your workshops, before you do anything, take some of this because you need to bring in the power of the tobacco plant because it's such a beautiful spirit. And it's very mild. You don't lose any, bodily control. I could take it and walk out in front of you 5 minutes later and you wouldn't have any idea that there was something going on with me. And yet, I would be feeling the spirit of this plant very strongly. It's really a beautiful spirit.
It's also legal. You can get it back into this country.
Yeah, it is. It's legal, yeah.
And so I'm assuming that's part of the whole communion with the plant would be with the spirit of the plant and a way to bring it in.
Yeah, it's a beautiful relationship they have with these plants. And it's true also with the ayahuasca and the datura. Now, datura is the most powerful and can be extremely dangerous. And even the schwa recognizes very strongly. A very small part of datura can put you in a trance state or what we might call a coma for 3 days to a week. And it grows pretty commonly in parts of the United States, Florida, for example, where I live part of the time. And kids learn that it's a powerful plant, and they'll take it and sometimes die. It's very powerful.
Doesn't it stop the heart or something?
Pardon me?
Doesn't it stop the heart, datura? It's
not
something
that I'm aware of.
Must be thinking of Jimson weed or something else, isn't it?
Digitalis also stops.
Oh, digitalis, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah,
okay.
That has a powerful effect on the heart. Jimson weed is, in many parts of the country, another name that's used for datura, although it's also some other plants go by that name. Datura is also called the trumpet flower. Hmm. And, for anybody who's listening and considering datura, I would say don't. Unless you're with somebody like a schwa who really, really knows the plant well. Very, very dangerous, and it's not to be fooled around with or experimented with.
Yep.
Ayahuasca, on the other hand, is a milder plant. It's a powerful plant. It's an incredible teacher plant, but it's not nearly as potentially lethal and dangerous as datura.
What kind of journeys have you had using these various plants?
You know, I've been around these plants, Loralee, since 1968. Funny, I went in the Peace Corps, graduated from Boston University Business School. I grew up in New England. In the 60s, I'd never smoked a joint of marijuana. I'd never done anything. I was really naive. And the first experience I had was with ayahuasca in the Amazon.
So if you're going to do it right, I guess, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I think I'm taking something like cough medicine. It tastes a little, it's not very good tasting. It tastes a little like cough medicine I had as a kid. I'm not realizing what I'm getting myself into here. I was very naive. But since then, since 1968, I've become pretty well acquainted with it. Also, on our trips to Ecuador, people have an opportunity. They're invited if they want to participate in this. They don't have to. And the trip leaders, like me, never do. When the people on our trips take plants, we do not. We want to be fully present for them.
Right.
And so I've seen a great many people. I've been with them as they've gone through these experiences. And I really believe that with these plants, you always get what you need at that particular point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And over the 30-plus years that I've experienced these plants, I'll have to say I've never experienced the same thing twice. And I really believe that each time it's what I need. And sometimes what I need is not real pleasant. You know, it's something I'm trying to avoid in my life.
Uh-huh.
And the plant forces me to look at it for a night.
Right.
And I know, having done this a million times, that the night's going to end. And I better confront it then and get it behind me. Take care of it during that night. That's what it's for. Get the arutam. Get this power that it can give you at that time. And then the next day, the slate is wiped clean.
And you can move on to the next lesson.
You can move on to the next thing. And other times when you take it, it's an incredibly wonderful, joyful adventure, because mm-hmm. that's what you need right then.
So is it visionary? Is it, you know, do you feel like you're, you know, right there in the alternate reality? What is it like?
It often is visionary and often very, very powerful vision, but not always. Sometimes that's not what people need. Sometimes people just get an incredible purging, a cleansing, where they do a lot of vomiting and they have diarrhea or whatever, where they get stuff in their system that they really, really need to get out.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, where they've got stuff in their system that they really, really need to get out. Yeah, I'm afraid we may have a little bad connection now.
Well, you know, I believe that the reason that you get what you need is because it's your soul speaking to you, maybe with the cooperation of other spirits in the alternate reality, and that there's many access routes to the alternate reality, not all of which need to depend on other plant spirits. Spirits, yes, but not necessarily plant spirits.
Well,
there's many spirits populating it, many access routes.
You hit the nail on the head, I think. And, you know, one of the things that I found is, I mentioned I've been familiar with these plants for 30 years, but I don't take them very often at all because I don't feel I need to. I mean, the journeying work that we do and what we teach in workshops, for example, in the United States, where we certainly don't use the plant here, on shape-shifting, on dream change, and so on, it's basically the same thing that you get from the plant. It's going into these altered states, you know, these journey states, shamanic journeys, whatever you want to call it, and it can be so powerful, and you don't need the plant.
Once the door's been thrown open, you've got the access route.
Right, and you don't even always need the plant to throw the door open. But I also do find that, for me, personally, connecting with that spirit of the plant in and of itself is very nice, and it helps to bring us back in contact with nature, which is something we miss so much in our culture.
Yep.
So when the schwa are constantly using these plants as friends and as teachers, it makes it helps them to really connect.
But there's so many different, there's thousands and thousands of plant species, therefore thousands and thousands of plant spirits, and they all have their role.
Yeah.
Right, you want to communicate with all of them, honor all of them, I would assume.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes just sitting in front of the plant, you know, you journey into its spirit. It doesn't have to be a psychotropic plant, but, you know, you can sit in front of a plant and you can really journey into it and feel it, and it has things to say to you, and you can talk to it, and it's beautiful, and remember, I graduated from business school.
So, Well, you know, I believe that these various cultures don't make stuff up, that they're very survival-oriented, they're very pragmatic, they're practical, and they're dealing with a reality that's there. And we're the ones that have just decided to shut it off for a while, although we're coming around back to it again.
So, you know, you can't survive in a place like the Amazon unless you're very, very deeply rooted in the reality of the place. And yet, the schwa will tell you that the reality of the place is very much connected to the dream world.
Yeah.
And that the waterfalls are part of the ancient Arutum spirits, that their grandparents are in the waterfalls and the anaconda and the jaguar, and that you can talk to all of these, you can feel it. And at the same time, they're extremely pragmatic and very, very great hunters and survivalists, you know, on that level. So, and as we talk about, you know, datura or tobacco, they also have the chicha beer that they drink a lot of. It's their main food source. It's a type of a beer. They've known for centuries that the rivers are not safe to drink because there's all kinds of organic matter in the rivers.
Oh.
So they drink this chicha beer, and they drink a lot of it. It's their main source of liquid. But you'd never see a drunk schwa. And, you know, you couldn't survive in the forest. They have to walk across a tiny log to get across a river.
They need their balance. They need
their
sensory input
intact.
Yeah.
So they never misuse. It's not misused.
Well, I have one comment, actually two. Indigenous societies all over the world have communicated, have participated, have explored this alternate reality. So it's not a mental illness, it's not a psychosis, it's not a figment of their imagination. I think it's there. When you have, you know, the majority agree on something, there's a consensus going on here. And if we choose not to explore and allow that, although many psychologists tell us we have a sixth drive to experience alternate reality, altered states, we have this God spot in our head, we're geared, we're hardwired to experience it. If our culture just decides to be materialistic and say, it doesn't exist because I can't touch it and feel it in this objective reality with my, you know, sensory input here, but they're ignoring all the other sensory input valves we have, then that's the fault of our culture. And it's something that I think we're going to heal and mend and come back around again, simply because science, as you were pointing out earlier, is telling us that the invisible realm is just as real as what our senses tell us is physical. My other question is, I'm having a discussion with somebody who had suggested to me that most hunter-gatherer societies depended mostly on meat, and I'm just going, I don't think so. Yeah, we have carnivorous, you know, canine teeth. You know, I'm sure that I'm having another argument with somebody who's wanting to believe that we're vegans primarily, and that's what we should be eating, and I'm going, no. I think we're omnivores. We're equipped to eat on all sides of the fence here. And on the other side, it's not a mainly meat-based diet. Sure, maybe the Neanderthals during the Ice Ages had to eat a little more meat. But I think that, and I wanted to ask you, someone who's been with an indigenous society, there must have been a lot of plant materials that they gathered, you know, nuts and seeds and berries and tubers and roots and leaves and on and on and on. So I think their diet must have been at least half to even more plant-based, right?
Yes.
That's my theory.
Well, the schwa basically will only eat one meal a day.
Oh, tell me about that.
The rest of the time, they drink a lot of this chicha, which is from the manioc plant. And it's very rich in starches and carbohydrates, which they need. They need a lot of energy. These are extremely well-built people. They're beautiful people, you know, very physical.
Uh-huh.
And they need these carbohydrates and starches. They drink a tremendous amount of chicha throughout the day, you know, in small quantities. And then usually once a day in the middle of the afternoon, they'll have one meal. And most of the time, it's pretty small. It may include a small piece of fish, or it might include a soup that has some birds in it. That they've killed a few birds. Or it might not include any meat at all. You know, usually they don't eat meat more than two or three times a week in general. They do eat meat, but not in the way that I was going to say that we do, but there's a lot of us who don't eat much meat now either. The way I was brought up, I guess, as a kid, where you always ate meat, you know.
Well, if you have to go and hunt it as opposed to go to the store and buy it, you know, you're going to eat less of it.
Well, yeah. And it's done in such a different way, too. I mean, before a schwa kills a bird, but uses a long blowgun, and, you know, he has permission. He has a conversation with the bird. And every bit of that bird is used for something, all the feathers, all the bones, everything. It's a very sacred process. So it's when they do eat meat, it's done in a very different way from the way we do it. And often not large animals. Sometimes they do eat wild boar, if they get one, or a tapir. Those things, are considered, especially if they're having a fiesta or something. But once again, the animal is deeply honored in this process.
I would also think that, the cooking and the preparing food is such a chore that it's not possible to do that 3 times a day. Who of us does? We just run to various fast food places, right? But to prepare a meal is another big energy outlay. So the once a meal makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and the Shwa don't like to work. They spend maybe 3 hours a day on average working. And the hunter goes out before dawn, and if he hasn't gotten on the days when he does go out, and if he hasn't gotten anything shortly after dawn, he gives up because most of the animals are kind of nocturnal.
Ah.
The women do most of the gardening early in the morning at the same time that the men are out hunting. And then they spend most of the rest of the day playing with the kids, teaching the kids songs, teaching the kids to swim, teaching the kids games, making love. They really live a pretty nice life in terms of that, and they don't like to create a lot of work for themselves. So
now that's another important lesson that's lost on us in the West, isn't it?
Certainly is.
Time management.
Well, we all come from those cultures, someplace back in our background. We came from one of those cultures, and we chose to go this route. And you know what? It amazes me. We're still choosing to go this route. I ask people at workshops, what's the most important thing to you? And almost everybody thinks it's free time.
Yep.
But our statistics show us that we work more today than we did 10 years ago.
Yep. Is that Puritan work ethic, I think. We're stuck in that.
Yeah, so, what's that all about?
One meal a day. I like that. Paul and I have been doing that. It really saves a lot of time and energy.
Yeah.
And I think you can survive nicely on one meal a day.
Yeah, and it's a real festive time, and it's usually in the middle of the afternoon. And the meal is served on these beautiful big leaves. That they only use plates, so there's no washing of dishes afterwards. But if there is meat served, it's usually cooked in leaves to give it a flavoring, a herbal type of leaves. So I wrap a bird in that, or fish or something in that, and then they serve it along with the manioc and the plantains and the fruits and vegetables that they eat on another huge leaf. It's like a big platter that each person has their own. We take groups there, and they get served for our food. We also have our own chefs that we bring in, and food available if you're vegan or whatever you are. We can accommodate you. But when they serve the schwa dish, it's so beautiful. It's such a wonderful presentation, and done with such ceremony. So that one meal a day is a very special one.
And bonding for the community, chance, yeah. Boy, we're out of time, but so much to say and to learn about this fascinating culture, the Shuar. John, thank you for all your good work over the last 30 years and helping to bridge old and new cultures and bring the best out in those experiential opportunities. And your books are wonderful. John's latest is Spirit of the Shuar, Wisdom from the Last Unconquered People of the Amazon. Thank you, John. It was John Perkins. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com